This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
And welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour. Jim Poplava and John Loeffler here. However, we are turning over the controls of the microphone for a conversation on stock investing in the year 2018 to Chris Poplava at Financial Sense Wealth Management and Chris Sheridan. And we'll be back later.
As of February 2018, the current economic expansion is now the third longest in U.S. history. Many have proclaimed its death over the years, but there is a good chance we may actually see a couple more records before all is said and done. Joining us on the show today is Chris Poplava. He's the Chief Investment Officer at Financial Sense Wealth Management. And Chris, if you wouldn't mind, set the backdrop for our audience and explain just how strong this bull market has been so far compared to the bull markets that we've seen in the past, because again, I mean, we're breaking a number of records here, aren't we?
We certainly are. As of December, we were at 102 months, putting us as the third longest expansion in U.S. history. And when you look at where we are, it's highly unlikely, given the economic momentum that we have, that we're going to be in a recession anytime soon. So I think there's a high likelihood that we're going to be at least a minimum of the second longest expansion in U.S. history. And quite frankly, I think we might be the longest expansion ever. I think we certainly have the possibility of seeing that in the next year. And what I looked at to kind of give me that analysis of really are we at risk of a recession, I was looking at some leading economic indicators that do a pretty good reliable job of kind of letting us know where real GDP will be. And for the most part, they're showing that we're going to be most likely having positive year-over-year growth this year. So that's why I think we'll probably make it through 2018 without a recession, and that would then place us as the second longest expansion ever. And until I start to see signs, some warning signs, I think there's a good chance, like I said, we might have the longest expansion in U.S. history. And what's interesting is we're not just setting records in the economy, we're also setting records in the stock market. And that's not surprising given that stocks tend to move with the economy over time. And when you look at the S&P, we are, I believe, the second longest bull market in history. And I believe will be the longest, quite possibly the longest. And the reason why I say that is we repeated a study done by Craig Johnson at Piper Jaffray. And what he was looking at was looking at data on the S&P 500 going back at least to 1928. What he wanted to do is see when the weekly RSI, which is essentially a momentum measure, hits at least 80. What were your future returns? And on average, what percentage of the time were you positive? And he was looking at 3 and 6 months and 12 months. And what he found was that over 80% of the time, when you see that level of momentum, it carries forward. And you have a high probability of positive returns looking out at 3, 6 months, or 12 months. And given that's the case, historically, we've had about 87% chance of having positive returns 1 year out. That's why I think, at least in the next 6 months or so, we're probably unlikely to have a bull market top. Tops are a process, and I don't see us forming a top anytime soon.
Okay, so again, we're currently the third longest when you look at the U.S. economic expansion. And you noted in your recent 2018 outlook that we posted on Financial Sense, I'll have a link out to that where this interview is located, but that if we go to May of 2018, then that will make us the second longest expansion we've ever seen. And then if we survive to July of 2019, a little more than 2 years from now, then it will officially become the longest U.S. expansion on record. So with the U.S. economy and both with the market, we are currently seeing records. If you look at leading indicators, and you have a chart here that all of you can look at, it's called a U.S. Risk Aversion Index that leads U.S. GDP, and it's showing that there's a good chance we're going to persist through this year without a recession. Give us an idea. Are you thinking 2019 is when we have to reassess conditions?
I think so. It's very hard to look beyond a year because so many things can change, whether it's fiscal policy, monetary policy, or even geopolitical events. I think it gets a little fuzzy looking out that far. That said, one thing that you can do is look at prior cycles. And when you see some certain hallmarks, you can estimate where a recession might occur. And that was something we did in the investment conference that we did back in October, is we're looking at prior cycles and a couple of markers and where we think based on where in the business cycle those occurred, if we already have those peaks, where the end, end of this cycle might be. And based on a couple of metrics that we were looking at, we felt, based on that, 2019 was probably the earliest that we could see a recession. And so just looking at the recent data, the recent LEIs, all that suggests that at a minimum, we're probably going to be going into 2019 without a recession. So at the earliest, I do think 2019 is the most likelihood of a recession. Anything earlier than that, I think it's just pure speculation and likely to be wrong.
And I want to note, in agreement with that, we've spoken to a really interesting company called Intensity Corporation out of San Diego, and they have a pretty large group of different PhDs, scientists, mathematicians, computer scientists, you name it, AI researchers, and they've developed a machine learning model that provides real-time projections of a U.S. recession. And they're lining up, when they use their own model, it's lining up for a reading of March of 2019, I think is the current output that it's giving. So that agrees with the data that you're looking at. When we look at the stock market, it is currently quite overbought, right? And there has been a lot of attention being paid to that because give us an idea. I mean, how overbought are we? Is this the most overbought we've ever seen the S&P 500 in the U.S. stock market? Or, is that, again, another record that we're approaching?
That's correct. When you look at the weekly RSI for the S&P 500, going back to 1928, this is currently the highest reading we have ever seen. So we almost have 100 years of history with this being a record, which is very interesting because one thing that I think is really good to kind of point out to listeners is that before you can form a top and start heading down, you have to stop heading up. And so when you think of a bull market top or an economic expansion, think of a cannonball being shot out of a cannon. First, you're accelerating up and forward, and then eventually you're just moving forward. You're not gaining altitude. You're starting to plateau. That's a topping process. You have no more upward momentum. It's now just going forward. And then eventually, based on gravity, now you're heading down. You form an arch. And what you typically see is, just like that cannonball in the law of gravity, you have to see a loss of upward momentum before you typically see the actual peak. And what this study, based on the RSI, tells us is, given that we are seeing record levels of momentum in the market, it is extremely unlikely that we are going to form a major market top anytime soon. There's just nothing in the breadth of the data technically to suggest any closeness to a market top. One thing, though, that I will say is I do think we'll have a little bit more volatility this year. That's not a real hard argument to make given the record low volatility that we've had. But when you look at how long we've gone, and again, we got data going back to the Great Depression, believe it or not, as of today, we have now gone the longest in S&P history without even a 5% pullback, which is, it's just incredible. And again, when you see this level of momentum and strength, rarely, if ever, do you see this near a market top. And that's why I think we're going longer. What's important, though, to really look at, and this is something that I then led the article towards that I wrote, was understanding that bull markets don't die of old age. Just because it might be the longest ever, there's no time clock to when a bull market ends. It needs a catalyst. And that's something that's really important, is to look historically at all the major market tops. What were some of the catalysts that were going on at the time that led to the eventual bull market top?
Okay, Chris, well, let's get into that. And I note in your article, Records Were Made to Be Broken, you have a study that you cite by JP Morgan, where they looked at four different, essentially, bear market macro drivers is what you referred to them as. And then you investigated each of those drivers based on your own data and indicators that you watch to see where we are currently. So if you wouldn't mind, set the background for our audience in terms of what that study was trying to reveal. And let's start with the first bear market driver, if you don't mind.
Absolutely. What JP Morgan did is they looked at the top 10 bull market tops that we've seen, going back to the crash of 1929, the 1937 bear market, post-World War II, the flash crash of 62. We saw the 1970 peak. We had the Volcker tightening with inflation now peak in the early 80s, the 87 crash, the tech bubble, and obviously 2007. And what they looked at was how big was the drawdown, how long it lasted, But what was really interesting to see was that they looked at four kind of macro drivers that were present at the time. The first one was recession. Yeah, every recession has led to a bear market, but not every bear market has led to a recession. And so if you look at all the catalysts, they had recession, commodity spike, which you can kind of think of an inflation spike, an aggressive Fed, and then also extreme valuation. And of all those four macro drivers, the number one that was most common was recession. And that's what I looked at first, is what are the odds that we are close to a recession on the horizon? And what's really important is I showed a figure going back to the Great Depression of the S&P 500, and I highlighted every period of recession that we've had since then. And when you visually look at that chart, you can see that most market declines in the S&P occur around recessions. And that's why it's so important to analyze the business cycle and understand what the risk is of sliding into a recession. And because of that, we created our own recession model. And what I typically see before being concerned about a recession on the horizon is a move north of 20 to 25% probability. Once you see that, I've only seen really one false signal, and that was in 1987. But outside of that, it's been done a pretty good job of predicting recessions and seeing them and witnessing them in real time. And as of right now, there's just no risk of recession based on where our indicator is.
Let's talk about the second bear market macro driver, which is a commodity spike. And you particularly looked at oil prices as part of this. As we all know, oil prices play a very important role. So let's talk about that portion of what could cause a bear market.
Sure. When you look at the CPI, it's often quoted as core CPI, where you strip out food and energy. The reason why they do that is what the Fed and others are trying to look at is what is the core trend in inflation. And if you look at headline inflation, which has food and energy, that is the most volatile component of the CPI on a year-over-year basis. So again, that's why you kind of want to strip out food and energy to see what the underlying rate of inflation is. There's times where inflation can be fairly high in the service sector, but based on what we're seeing in commodities and gasoline prices, they could be declining. We saw that in 2014 and 15 and 16 when oil prices collapsed. But yet, if you looked at service inflation, it was still relatively elevated, I believe over 2%. So the reason why this is important is think of shocks to the economy and the ability for consumers and businesses to adapt. It's kind of like when you have something that moves very slowly, interest rates or inflation, if it increases gradually, everyone can slowly begin to adapt their habits to that. But when it comes aggressively and in a short time, it's a shock to consumer balance sheets, to corporate profit margins, and that's why sometimes a spike in commodity prices can lead to a recession. And what was interesting was in the last cycle, not only was the U.S. economy slowing from the collapse of the housing market, but it also underwent a commodity spike when oil went up to $145 a barrel. And so that's why that was more of an intense recession. There was a lot of factors contributing to the decline at the time. And the most common commodity spike is stemming from oil. And that's why I looked at the year-over-year price change of crude oil and how that typically correlated with either a recession and or a bull market top. The question being, you know, what is the likelihood that we're going to see oil prices double on a short time span of 6 months to a year? And in my opinion, I think the odds of a spike in oil are low outside of a geopolitical event. Obviously, if we went to war with North Korea, you know, all bets are off. But barring some major geopolitical event, what was fascinating is that U.S. oil production is anticipated to eclipse Saudi Arabia for the first time ever, meaning that the U.S., not Saudi Arabia, is more of a marginal driver of oil prices. And so with U.S. production ramping up and hitting new records, at the same time, if you look at our rig count, it's far below where it was in 2014. The potential for U.S. oil production growth to continue is very significant. Secondly, while I didn't display any of the graphics, I do believe that China is going to be slowing down this year. And given that China is responsible for the marginal player of global growth, if China slows, you're going to start to feel that in oil prices and other commodities. You know, with China beginning to decelerate, at the same time U.S. oil production is hitting record levels, I think these two factors are enough to keep the price on oil, you know, relatively constant, or at least not seeing a commodity spike.
Okay, so when we look at the bear market macro drivers, there's four of them again. We talked about recession being the first, a commodity spike being the second. So the third bear market macro driver is an aggressive Fed. And this is something that we talk about on Financial Sense News Hour quite regularly, is the Fed's influence on the business cycle. There's a lot of people citing that as a risk for 2018 if they were to raise four times instead of three times, given an increase in inflationary pressures. But again, this is another factor that you don't yet think is a cause for concern when we think about the bull market. So why is that?
Well, you know, as you mentioned, one thing I have a chart of, and I think this clearly illustrates how oftentimes it's the Fed raising interest rates that causes the economic downturn and financial crisis, is looking at the Fed funds rate going back to the 70s, you can see that it typically spikes and rises dramatically prior to the onset of a recession. And oftentimes there's some player out there who has too much margin that collapses. In the 80s, you know, we saw Latin America. In the 70s, we saw Franklin National bankruptcy and so forth. And so that's obviously a concern given the Fed is raising interest rates right now. Typically, a lot of people use the yield curve. So they use the Fed funds rate to measure short-term interest rates, and they measure a spread between a long-term interest rate like the 10-year treasury relative to the federal funds rate. And that's traditionally positive. You have an upward sloping yield curve. Oftentimes, though, the Fed gets very aggressive on the short end, and it's enough that bond investors are beginning to worry about the next economic downturn. And so rather than selling long-term bonds, they're actually buying them for safety, driving long-term interest rates down. And they can drive them down enough, and the Fed can raise short-term interest rates enough that you actually have a negative yield curve. This is not a requirement for a recession, but it often is something you see before a recession. So assuming long-term interest rates stay where they are, if the Fed does raise three to four times, it is quite possible that we could have an inversion to the yield curve later this year. So it's something to keep an eye on, but there's no near-term risk coming from that now, given that we've got at least several rate hikes before we would have an inversion. Another thing I looked at was looking at where the Fed funds rate is relative to market interest rates and relative to how fast the economy is growing. And based on that, if the Fed is raising interest rates at a higher level than general market rates, and at the same time, faster than, let's say, the rate of growth in the economy, that would be an aggressive Fed. And so based on that concept, I developed a Fed funds neutral index. So, and I'm essentially looking at when you're negative, that means the Fed is easy. When you go positive, that is when the Fed is too tight, and it measures how tight the Fed is. And my indicator shows that often at times we literally go from negative to positive right when a recession begins. And given where we are right now, I think we're ways off from any risk of an aggressive Fed being one of the catalysts to end the bull market in stocks.
Okay, before we get on to extreme valuations, I want to camp on your federal funds risk neutral index for a second, because I think this is really important to point out that some people may say that because the Fed is increasing rates, that that's aggressive. But how do you quantitatively judge or assess whether or not the Fed is tight or loose? It's not just a matter of whether or not they're increasing rates or decreasing rates. Like you pointed out, you have to use the level of rate increases relative to market interest rates and the pace of economic growth. So that's how you've essentially quantitatively measured relative Fed tightness or looseness. Did I get that correct?
That's exactly correct. So, for example, if the Fed is somewhat tight, but there's so many other drivers in the economy going on, whether it's from fiscal stimulus, tax reform, or who knows what, like the huge productivity gains that we saw in the 90s, essentially, you know, the growth momentum of the economy is so strong that it would, you know, even if the Fed is somewhat aggressive, it's not enough to essentially extinguish the recovery and expansion in the economy. It's when the Fed is so tight that its tightness, or how much interest rates are short-term above long-term rates, that, you know, if that exceeds where essentially the economy is growing, that would be a concern. And as of right now, we don't see that.
So that is, again, a really important indicator to have on the dashboard when you're thinking about risk management, whether or not you should be allocating into various asset classes and to which degree, because if you start to see that risk measure going vertical, showing that the Fed is tightening faster than the pace of economic growth and relative to market interest rates, that's a definite risk off signal. But again, we're not seeing that yet. And so they're still relatively loose, even with the Fed rate hikes that they've done already. And I guess we'll have to be monitoring this going forward too for 2018, you know, whether or not they do 3 or 4 and the impact that that is going to have. Let's move to the fourth component that you mentioned earlier, which is extreme valuations. Of course, I think all of us know listening are aware of the fact that evaluations are very stretched by some measures. You know, we're either below the tech bubble or even above the tech bubble. So it depends on which measure you're looking at, but valuations are stretched. So let's talk about that and how that fits into the conversation that we've been discussing so far about what may cause a bear market going forward.
Sure. You know, I think one thing that just sometimes a picture says 1,000 words. And to me, the Economist magazine cover from last October, it did that. The title was "The Bull Market in Everything." And it has a bull, and its horns have various asset classes and things in there. Cryptocurrencies, homes, stock prices. It literally had almost everything. And that's kind of what we've seen. We've seen bonds rally. We've seen real estate rally. We've seen equities rally. International assets have increased in value. We've essentially had a bull market almost in everything. And I think that's really important to kind of get an idea of in terms of sentiment is some of the bull market killers were extreme valuations. And eventually things tip in terms of sentiment and value then begins to be cleared from the market. And one of the things that was interesting was a study done by the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. And what they were looking at was the rise in net worth to income ratios. Essentially, they were looking at the value of financial assets relative to income. Income being somewhat of a measure of general levels of activity in the economy or, you know, for improvement. And then how much asset prices have reflected that. And that would tend to make sense. If the economy is improving, you would tend to see asset prices do well with that growth. As I mentioned to you, if you look at the stock market, it typically follows, you know, what the economy does. Again, when we have a recession, oftentimes we have a bear market. And so when you see extremes in terms of the fluctuation in asset prices relative to the economy, and in this measure that the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco used was income levels, that could be a clue that you've hit an extreme and you might see things revert the other way. In talking about valuations, what they looked at was the current price-to-earnings ratio standardized over the last 10 years, and they're basically approximating zero real growth in equity prices for the next decade. And what they also looked at was that it's not just stocks that are elevated, as I mentioned. It's multiple asset classes, real estate, pensions, life insurance reserves, equities. They've all been contributors to seeing this spike in net worth, household net worth income. And it has reached a record high, believe it or not. When you look at where we were in the housing bubble of 2007 and where net worth was to disposable income or where household net worth was relative to nominal GDP, we also in that exceeded the level of 2000. A lot of people realize that tech stocks were the most elevated ever in 2000. That's true, but your home is the largest asset for a household. And so that's why we saw actually a greater spike in net worth to disposable income or GDP in the 2007 top was because of how much asset prices went up in real estate and in equities. Now, again, we have a bull market in everything. And given that, it's not surprising that we are hitting an all-time high in financial asset values relative to economic ones like disposable income or nominal GDP. And what is really important to note was, and this is, I'm quoting the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, they said, quote, "Historically, these ratios have not remained elevated for a prolonged period, and peaks have been followed by reversions toward their long-run averages." That's a concern. When you look at the chart, you can see that these spikes in financial asset values relative to economic variables, it's very clear they don't camp at those high levels. They revert. So where's the most likely next reversion? It's down. And that's not going to be from a huge surge in disposable income or a massive boom to the economy, which is the denominator of that ratio, more often than not, it's the numerator, which is the value of financial assets, that then corrects. So when you look at in terms of the bull market killers, to me, valuations is, I would call it extreme. And that is something that has been present at many market tops that we've seen in the past. According to J.P. Morgan, they would classify extreme valuations, you know, just before the Great Depression, the 1929 crash. They also highlighted 1946 top, the 1961 top, the 1987 top, and the 2000 top as seeing extreme valuations. And so when you look at the four checkboxes, I can clearly say we've got one of them checked. And I will be looking at those other three, the risk of a recession, a commodity spike, an aggressive Fed, to kind of give me an idea that we're getting a lot closer to the exit. As of right now, based on where valuations are, I'm clearly looking at the exit, but I just don't think we're there yet.
Chris, boil this down for us, taking these four different bear market macro drivers that we discussed and some of the things that we discussed earlier in terms of how long this bull market has lasted, some of the economic indicators that you look at. If you wouldn't mind, give our audience an idea of what is your outlook going forward for this year in general? What are you doing for clients of Financial Sense Wealth Management? What would be some practical advice that you could give?
Don't ignore the data. I think that would be the best advice. You know, you might have your own bearish view or bullish view, but you have to have some way to test that. And for me, it's the data. If you're bearish and you think the U.S. economy is going to fall into recession and we're going to have a bear market, what data are you citing? You know, what is the catalyst? Do you see the hallmarks of a recession on the horizon or a bear market? If not, then you have to be bullish. But one thing I argue, and again, I think we are going to see one of the longest bull markets in history and longest economic expansions in U.S. history. But given that, I am not saying in any stretch of the imagination to throw caution to the wind. Just the opposite. It's essentially understanding that we probably have some more upside to equity markets and we probably have a little bit more upside to the economy. And so the way to, you know, increase your returns is to not get out too early. If you get out too early, you can leave a lot of money on the table. And one of the studies that we found was that if you sell up to, I believe, 6 months past every major market top and you get out or get into a bull market by 6 months late, you can still add considerable value to a buy and hold approach. You do not have to be perfect in terms of your market timing to add long-term value to your returns. And so that's why I would say don't get out too early, because markets can surprise you by extending a lot farther and further than you can imagine. If you look at housing values in the last cycle, they were exceptionally expensive. And yet the housing market kept going on longer than most anticipated. Same thing with the tech bubble. If you remember Alan Greenspan's mid-1990s speech of irrational exuberance, the market went on several years before it finally put in a top. And you would have missed out on doubling your money during that period. So again, it's very important to always check your emotions at the door, understanding what the market is telling you, not think that you are smarter than the millions and millions of people collectively who are investing in the stock market or the bond market and other markets. Really listen to what the general message is of what the market is saying. And if you do that, I think you'll have a lot more clarity and make the right decisions for investing.
We've been speaking with Chris Poplava, the Chief Investment Officer at Financial Sense Wealth Management. And Chris, before you go, would you mind telling our audience the best way that they could contact you to find out about Financial Sense Wealth Management's investment services or to discuss any of the things that were brought up in today's show?
Absolutely. They can email me at chris.poplava@financialsense.com. That's chris.poplava@financialsense.com.
Jim, interesting conversation between, we call them Chris and Chris, Chris Sheridan and Chris Poplava, yeah, the CNC group here. What are we looking forward on the program in the weeks to come?
Well, we're still in the middle of earnings season, so that will be with us for most of the month of February. But then we have the FOMC meeting in March. They did a pass in January, did not raise rates. And Powell will be Fed chairman, so it'll be interesting to see what the Fed says. They're projecting 3 rate increases for the year. They skipped January, so will they raise in March? We'll be looking at that. We're looking at the 10-year yield on bonds. Will bonds break out and head over 3% if economic economic growth accelerates along with inflation, and you still have a forecast for $70 and $80 oil, what will that mean for the market? So these are things we're going to keep our eye on. So that's coming up in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.